www.newsnet.org.nz.
Welcome to Books and Beyond with your hosts, Karen and Louisa. Join us for half an hour of information, entertainment, reading recommendations, and beyond. Brought to you by Auckland Libraries.
I know this girl, and she works in a library, yeah. Standing there behind the counter, willing to help with all the problems that I encounter.
Kia ora, everyone. With me today is children's book author Peter Millett. He's here to talk about his new book, a children's picture book, More Classic Rhymes for Kiwi Kids. More because it's a follow-up to Classic Rhymes for Kiwi Kids, which I think Peter came out a year ago.
That's right.
So kia ora, Peter.
Hey, great to be here.
So as a librarian who does regular rhyme and rhyme time sessions in the library with preschoolers, I just love your books.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind of you to say.
In fact, I need to add them to my repertoire. So please tell us more about them and why should we be reading them to our children, and perhaps even what ages these rhymes are suitable for?
Well, I got the idea myself when I was a child. I listened to Peter Sinclair reads Aesop's Fables on record, vinyl.
Wow.
And that was the first time ever I'd heard a New Zealand accent read a famous tale, mid-70s. And I thought, well, that's really good because we don't have badgers and foxes. And so I took that memory to my adulthood and I thought, well, let's make the animals New Zealand animals, kakapo, kia, weta. So ideally, these rhymes will be for, I guess you could start when you're at kindergarten and then the early years at primary school. But hopefully you'll start off with these versions first, then come upon the English fables and rhymes.
Mm-hmm. Rather than the other way around, like it was when we were children.
Yeah, yeah. You can have both. Buy one, get the other one free. But I think it would be nice to set them in New Zealand. That's always was my goal, simply to, I would have loved to have had that as a child, to start with the local stuff. We used to spend summers on our uncle's farm in Te Awamutu, so, you know, being out amongst the wildlife was just completely normal and natural, and I wanted to include that in the stories. So as well as the younger viewers, the parents and the grandparents also can go along with what I'm trying to do for everybody.
Yeah. Okay, so it's a bit of nostalgia for the reader, a new experience for the listener, for the child. And also I picked up there a bit of a rural experience for the urbanite family.
Yeah, it's a good mix because I've got Waikato farming experience from my own childhood, and Scott, who is very clever with the illustrations, he's a high country hunter in Queenstown.
So,
you know, we've got a wide
talented
range. He is. I mean, the first rhyme about Kia stealing a clock from a camper van, that's probably research he did in his backyard.
Yes. Am I allowed to give it a read?
Yeah, go for it, yeah.
Hickory dickory dock, the Kia nicked off of the clock. The clock struck two, the Kia shot through. Hickory dickory dock.
And that's exactly what I was after. So people will initially be shocked at the reboots and the redoings, but then it will grow on you and think, yeah, that's cool, we can work with that.
Yeah, it's catchy and it's Kiwi.
It's Kiwi.
Yeah.
I call it Fred Dagg meets Mother Goose. And if Fred was still alive, I think he'd be okay with that.
Yeah, true. And I enjoyed reading that, actually. I wanted to ask about the illustrations by Scott, actually, because I love the illustrations. Yeah. And I know listeners can't see what I'm talking about. I'm sorry. But they're really cool. And we had Kevin Mialamu earlier this year.
Oh, yep.
Former All Black and illustrator. So it's always intrigued me how do authors and illustrators find each other?
Well, it's a fascinating way to get together. The publisher is the camp mother, if you want to use that term. So they arrange the event. So you have the author on the left side, the illustrator on the right side. You generally don't meet each other until you've finished the book. So, and that may be geographic. There may be other reasons. So, but you kind of, by the time you've got to the end of the book, you both know each other inside out because one's going in the other person's head.
Wow.
But we don't start
off. An interesting relationship.
It is.
Very modern, actually.
It is. We do not start off.
An online relationship.
not quite like that. But we start off from different worlds. And I guess if we use the Camp Mother analogy, the publisher needs to be having the overview in their head. They want the finished goal. So the writer and the illustrator may come at it initially from a different slant or an mm-hmm. angle. So that's where it could become a little bit uneven if one person says, hey, I really think this is how where we're heading. So I think you need a neutral party to say, this is the end result, this is the audience.
Yeah.
Can we both just learn as we go and then we finish together?
Yeah, new creative types are difficult.
It's called herding cats.
Yes.
It is possible, but it usually doesn't work.
Oh, that's really interesting. Okay, so there's no Tinder type app out there to sort of introduce you all. The publishers do job and manage the process.
Well, you would know, like working in the library industry, so everything is very, very, very well behaved and very formalised, and there's mm-hmm. there's a round peg for a round hole in most situations. Yeah. So, yeah, it's all very orderly. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Thank you for that. I've always been intrigued by how that works. So actually, Peter, you will be pleased to know the library has ordered copies of your book, Too Many to Count.
Great.
For which will be available for families to borrow over summer.
Brilliant.
So
brilliant.
There you go. And
great.
Amongst some of your other books, which I found in the Central City Library and realised they're... This is not your first book, is it?
No. And sitting here watching them on your table is, in some cases, the first time I've seen some of these books in more than 2 decades.
Uh-huh.
And that's a good problem to have. I'm actually losing track of the books that I wrote at the start of my career.
Right, yeah. You started, what, 1998, was it?
Yeah, I actually, in 96, started really formally applying to do writing in terms of submitting scripts. But 98, I got my first contract to do, and I see the book there. It's... one I've long lost almost, Gene Batten. And that was a non-fiction reference book with a little bit of a nice twist at the end. So that book I don't even remember what the story has in it. And that's because I've been doing this for a couple of decades and I've written, I think, 70 or 80 books now. And I don't know any author who can actually go back to the beginning and vividly recall the structure of the story, how the characters interacted with each other. It's just you start to lose track of what's going on. So it's ironic seeing books here.
Yeah.
I'd have to do a quick read to come back up to speed again.
Oh, cool. Well, you can borrow my copy then and reacquaint yourself with your own book. So the Gene Batten book was your very first published work. Okay.
Yeah.
So do you remember the process involved to getting that? Was it a difficult thing to do back in 1998? Or was it a different process to now?
I think it's a difficult answer. I think you'd have to say it was easier. In 1998. Okay, you couldn't do it yourself. That was not an option, but there were simply more publishers available on deck making books. So in that case, it was Reed New Zealand. They almost got to 100 years and then they closed down. So, and we've seen probably in the last 5 years, at least half a dozen publishing houses close down in New Zealand through many different reasons. So back in 98, we hadn't had the global financial crisis. We hadn't had e-books come out of nowhere. So everything was much like it would have been in 1968, you know. So you were able to go into... I did a community writing course at the local college on a Thursday night.
Ahead of your time. It's such a popular thing to do these days.
Well, I suppose it is, yeah. And one of the tutors there had some experience writing books for children. My wife went with me. I dragged her along. She was, so why are you doing this? You know nothing about children's books. But I guess that's like anything. If you want to learn a language, you've got to start somewhere. So I went along to this course for a few weeks. Nothing remarkable happened. But at the end of the course, I mentioned to the tutor, look, if I do create an idea, what do I do next? And she said, well, here are some people that might respond to a phone message or a letter, a couple of names. And I did do that, and I actually ended up playing phone tag with the publishing director at Reed, and I think he felt sorry for me. It was easier to just say come in than continue playing phone tag messages.
Ah,
we had a meeting.
Very clever.
The story that I thought was wonderful, I just saw his face drop. I thought, uh-oh, well, I'm in deep trouble here. And the parting comment was, but I've got another idea, and he loved that other idea, which turned into Gene Batten. So I guess for me, the risk always is looking like a fool or getting out of your depth. But I've learned the valuable lesson. It's not so bad if you do look like a fool for a moment or two, because you might learn something pretty crucial from that exercise. That's better to do that than hold back and never put it forward. It's better to take a chance that you look a bit dumb and who knows what might happen. So the side effect of that meeting arguably has led to 2 decades of writing. If I'd never gone to that meeting, or if I hadn't continued to play phone tag, I don't know. I don't know. Ships in the night, who knows?
Yeah, that is a very inspiring story because, yeah, if we don't put ourselves out there, we don't know what we're missing out on.
And where it was easier then to now, you can't do that in 2018. You can't.
What do we do in 2018?
Well, I think everything is so much... I'm working with my son at the moment, we're looking at summer jobs. Everything is like, don't come and see us, just go to our website. But the problem is it's like a number, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very impersonal.
It's very impersonal. So I think people, rightly so, are getting quite creative. They're making their own books. They're making their own e-books. There might be some people who read it theatrically on YouTube and appeals to a certain movement, you know. So I think we're having to diversify away from what was a straightforward process of finding an editor, giving them a topic to consider, and then going through the feedback process. That has stopped. You're now sent to a website, join 1,000, 10,000 other people, and good luck. Mm-hmm. I'm constantly finding people saying, good luck. Maybe it is actually working for me now, but yeah. It becomes such a cliche, you tire of it very quickly.
Yeah. Now, from listening to you say that then, so the step that you had along the way is that Reed Publishing sort of helped you finesse your first work.
Yes.
So you don't have that feedback, that critique coming back to you. So people are self-publishing. So what do they do now?
Look, I mean, it's really hard. I'm right now, I won't go into the full details, I'm dealing with an editor in London. We're going back and forth on a picture book story. I think I've learnt more from him in 30 days than I learnt in 20 years of writing myself. This guy's really experienced. I don't know how long he's been doing it, but it's like a masterclass. I'm in a submission pitching process with him. You know, we're trying to see if he will accept my concept for the idea. So that to and from, I've had 7 emails. I've changed the story 7 times. I've rewritten it almost from scratch every time. We need that as writers. We really do. I don't do writing courses for adults, or I don't charge people to come to me to tell them how to write. I think I'm just starting to get more familiar right now at this point in my career with the understanding the structure aspect of it. But it's you do need mentors to help you develop as a writer, and they're very hard to come by. Very, very difficult. It's a bit like
Is that the next stage in the industry and the trend of the creative writing is the next stage, the mentor, the editor?
Possibly, but you know how that's funded, I'm not sure. But we certainly need mentors, even experienced writers, because it isn't. There isn't a book on how to write a story.
Library's got lots of books on how to be a creative writer, actually.
They do, but it's just one of those things. There isn't ever going to be, here's the 21-step process to do this. You can learn some pretty fancy dancing on the stars with enough training. But with writing, it's so personal and difficult to know what to do. So yes, any self-published writer or someone trying to break into the industry would benefit enormously from a mentor if they could find one.
Mm-hmm.
And even an experienced writer, I'm learning things. So I'm thinking, I genuinely didn't know those two things. After all this time, I did not know. And those two things are really important. So, yeah.
Wow, the handy hands. Thank you so much, Peter.
Yeah.
But I read your interest. Well, it's actually in the back of some of your books. Your interest in writing began at primary school when you had a poem published in the New Zealand Herald. Was it called the New Zealand Herald?
Yeah.
So wow, what a buzz that must have been.
And apologies in advance for not being able to recite that poem.
That was my question.
No, I have found a workaround. I have located that Herald article. And it's been scanned into PDF form, and it will go onto my website. Okay, so
well done.
Again, I'm struggling from stories from 1998, 78, no chance. But the thing was, in the classic rhymes, it would have been something along those lines of poking cheeky fun and making it Kiwi eyes.
Yeah.
So there are some things about your personality that I don't think ever change. You know, I really don't. If you were like my dad is an aeroplane buff. Warbirds over Wanaka. That must have started from a young age. He grew up during World War II. He's 75, 6 now, still is passionate about planes. So for me, having fun with rhymes, I listen to Pam Ears on the radio, Spike Milligan, all those people, something burned into my brain that I really liked doing that. So what I was doing at school with my friends, passing around this rhyme or giving it to the Herald, really what I'm doing now is just on a bigger scale. More people are seeing the rhymes.
Yeah.
And I got paid $1 for going in the Herald. So that was my first publishing contract.
You got paid for your very first published work. Well done, you.
And in 1978, $1 almost could have bought you a house in Auckland, I assume. So
Not quite, nearly.
Maybe a backyard. But, you know, it's funny, isn't it, how you just do something. But the thing was, I never assumed that that would lead to a job because I didn't know any New Zealand writers as a child. I hadn't heard of them.
Yeah.
Because even Margaret Mahe was effectively a British author. She was publishing her books in Britain, and they would only arrive here as imports. You didn't see Margaret Mahe doing a school visit, for example. The only author I knew of was Roald Dahl. I didn't know anyone else.
So she was writing for the British audience as well. Well, speaking of Margaret, in your book, The Anzac Biscuit Man, she's written a foreword, which I really... And you talking about how your passion for New Zealand rhymes was way back in primary school.
Yeah.
So if you don't mind, I'll just read what Margaret wrote, because she writes it so expertly.
And I haven't read this since she wrote it, so it'll be new for me again as well.
Okay, so starting partway through the first paragraph, probably only New Zealand readers will catch on to the unexpected language in which those stories are being retold, those stories being yours in the book.
Yeah.
The essentially Kiwi character and idiom that transforms these familiar nursery rhymes, or tales, I'm sorry, and makes them intimately our own. In any book, stories are inevitably presented as print on the page. But these stories need a spoken voice to make the most of them. They need to be read aloud by a reader who's able to rejoice in their alliteration, in their games, with words and their essential exaggerated New Zealand utterance, which they celebrate even while they are making fun of it. Older children who are already familiar with the classic stories are the readers and listeners most likely to appreciate the game that is being played here, both with stories and from a British past and from language from a Kiwi present. These versions do not replace the old stories, which they celebrate even while they joke with them. Peter Millett, this is what Margaret writes about you. Peter Millett reveals himself as a storyteller with a true response to language. And though the stories remain the simple nursery tales they originally were, they now engage the New Zealand listener in a totally different way. Margaret Mahe, 2006.
Wow, that's fantastic, isn't it?
Lovely.
That's a mentor.
Yes.
Margaret was very
generous.
How
did that happen? How did she get to write the foreword in your book?
Well, again, easier in 98, the community of writers was smaller. There were only a few options to be published. So those few brave souls knew each other. And I was very fortunate that Margaret welcomed me onto the scene as a newbie. I would have been in my early 20s or mid-20s, and I felt quite out of my depth. You know, it's a third former with the prefix, the seventh form.
Yeah.
You know, when do they say go away? But no, she was always generous to people, and I phoned her up. I've had a few other different writers' phone numbers. They're not the sort of people you phone up to say, you know, what do you think about the cricket results? You don't do that. You might phone them once in a decade.
Yeah.
And if you do phone them, it's something important.
Was it hard to actually pick up the phone and say, I'm going to give this a go?
Yes.
I was just thinking of myself in that situation.
Yeah. Her and I had to phone Sir Edmund Hillary. Both of those were quite daunting moments. And I never know how to introduce myself. For Ed, it was Sir Ed. This is Peter from Torbay calling.
Probably really like that.
Yeah,
I'm Sir Ed from New Zealand.
Yeah, I struggled, so that's all I could think of. Yeah, But he was lovely, and the book that we were doing at the time with the Gene Batten that never turned to fruition, but he would have been part of that series.
Yes,
and
what
he said, sounds like a good idea. I'm all for that. And the classic thing is, where else in the world? I tell you a secret. You could have phoned Sir Edmund Hillary. You go to the phone book and you look up under Hillary and E.
Really?
He left himself in the phone book.
The good old white page.
He was just like every other New Zealand. And I think Margaret, to the same extent, really anybody could have called her, but people didn't because she's the queen, you know, so you don't mess with that. But she was never said no to anybody who had a question for her or was seeking some mentoring. So I was very lucky to have an early start of my life and have a writer like that be supportive. Amazing. Mm. Yeah,
well done.
Amazing. Yeah.
And that was but I understand you were also very generous with your time. So perhaps, you know, giving back as those mentors did, those New Zealand icons. So I understand you also go into local schools and read and entertain the children.
Yep.
Is it a one-man show?
It is turning into a variety show. My wife is a teacher, Ruth, and I would say Ruth is my number one mentor. She is a year six, 25-year experienced primary teacher. And I started writing stories for her first class that she taught in. And that's where everything took off. So the kids responded. I'd go and sit at the back of the classroom and watch her read the story to the children and see how they reacted. You know, so if you've got kids sitting there captivated, great. If you've got kids picking nose and pulling hair, you've got issues with your story. So that's what I'd strongly recommend to anyone who's new. Go for the acid test. Don't you read it. Let someone else read it and you watch how they react.
Yes, because I've done the roadshow thing for libraries before going into schools and reading and entertaining them, and it's absolutely exhausting. exhausting, and it's full on. That's a handy hint as to prepare yourself by watching, observing first.
Yes.
And then
because the kids are great. They don't have time in their lives to muck around wasting on things they don't want to do.
They're spontaneous, aren't they?
They are. And boy, it's a difficult... Like, I constantly hear this argument, is it easier writing for kids or writing for adults? This will be controversial. This might get you some ratings. It is...
Go ahead.
It is harder to write for adults, okay? And this will... There'll be people groaning all around in the kids' lit community right now. It is harder to write for adults. However, the thing is, the risk factor is way higher on kids because they will just walk away from you. You know, at least an adult reader will go right through and maybe go on Goodreads and say, it wasn't what I expected, but I finished it. Not with kids. If they're not into you, you're out of the game.
Yeah.
And the highest...
Ruthless.
Ruthless.
Yeah, the old X factor thing.
But the highest risk factor, which I've decided to do, is stand-up comedy in front of school children. My Johnny Danger book on the table there features a character who's larger than life, who is a jokester and a prankster. So I go into visits emulating him. I go dressed as James Bond because he's dressed as James Bond. And I start with a dad joke. And so far, touch wood, about 99% of people have been on board with that first joke. But if it doesn't work, I'm dead meat. You try and tell dad jokes to 12-year-olds who... don't find you funny.
Yeah, well, they are the masters of dad jokes, aren't they, really?
They are. So my time spent with children has evolved from those sort of covert listening into the kids reading to standing in front of a class, to standing in front of a three-class set, and then to an entire school, so 500 people. And that simply took a lot of time, 20-odd years of just doing it, to get to that level of understanding how everything works. So I can see... the back of the class right away, back of the hall. I know where the problem areas are. The people that I have to work a bit harder. Sometimes the teachers can't see what I can see, you know. So it is, yes, in some respects, I guess you call that generous. But for me, this is why I do what I do. I do this for my child reader audience. You know, they are my world that I write for. So I need to be in that world. When I was in the workforce as a travel agent...
So it contributes... that was what I was going to ask, is why do you do it then? Why most authors, you know, they don't, especially children's authors, they don't have that profile. We don't get to see them, like you were saying earlier.
Well,
so you're on stage in front of them.
Yeah, I'm just simply acting out my stories. So when I worked in a travel agency, I was completely removed from my audience.
You worked as a travel agent?
Yeah, that's why I went from school straight into working as a travel agent.
Uh-huh.
And then a children's writer. Yeah, that's obvious, isn't it?
No, but that's why I'm sort of going, you worked as a travel agent.
I know.
Wow.
But when I married Ruth, who was a teacher, so a travel agent marries a teacher, and then he sees the children reading stories, and then he remembers back to his own childhood thinking, well, that's what I used to do. I used to write those stories and pass them around. And I had one published in the Herald, so why do we do that again?
Yeah.
So it was a huge sea change.
Creative writing course.
Huge sea change. But I think what I've discovered is I now act out my stories in front of people. It's just the way I prefer to do it. I could sit and read to them, and then it becomes an intellectual experience. So they listen to the words. But when we listen to stories, movies play in our head, we're visual. Our eyes are working on the other way around. So we actually play pictures. We don't simply list characters. We show pictures. So you know, maybe this is me experimenting a bit. I like to take risks. I'm acting out visually. So I bring props along. I have a banana phone. I arrive with a parachute, a real parachute from the US Air Force. I have videos playing behind me, special effects. So the only thing I don't have is smoke machines. I'm worried about health and safety.
Right. Yeah, so we're talking about Johnny Danger. So I have, it's a fiction book.
Yeah.
And it's got the Auckland Library's level 6 sticker on, which means it's a chapter book for advanced readers.
Wow, good.
Yeah. And so so this one is, Johnny is Lie Another Day.
Yes.
And so what inspired then the series of, so we've moved away from picture books now, we're in your fiction books. And
yeah.
We're in a superhero, is it still influenced by, is it still homegrown?
Yeah, it is. It's DIY Spy. If you look at the, maybe it's on the second book, the DIY Spy was what I wanted them to label the series to start with, Do-It-Yourself Spy. So he is, how Kiwi is that? You know, he cobbles together things. So he makes his own weapons from everyday objects. He also uses, in this particular book you've got in your hands, his secret cryptic spy code is calculator spelling.
Oh, I can see that, yeah.
So each chapter...
It's on the cover, by the way.
It is on the chapter. And I hopefully I can do this at the speed of sound. Each chapter that I have here features calculator numbers. So this one here, you read that number out.
80814.
Turn it around.
Oh, yes, very clever.
What does that say?
Hi, 808.
No, hi, Bob.
Hi, Bob.
Yeah, okay. So if you're reading the story, you will get clues from the chapter headings. So that's born from my experience at Harakee Primary School in the 70s. That was our PlayStation, calculators.
Yeah.
And I don't know when you went to school, but there was...
Well, my boys would have loved it. I mean, they're in their mid-20s now, but they would have loved it.
Yeah. Well, we were thrilled when you didn't have to plug the calculator into the wall socket.
That's true. With the solar power.
These were mobile, handheld calculators. And we used to charge around the playground writing Shell Oil upside down with numbers.
That's
mind-blowing.
Right.
So yes, certainly Johnny Danger was, it's kind of a long tale. This series was acquired by Penguin Random House Australia at the London Book Fair in 2013 or something. So that's miles and miles away from Takapuna, Auckland.
That's true. Well done.
But it's infused with Kiwi sensibility. We can't afford, usually in New Zealand, to have things, so we have to improvise them. So he's an improvised DIY spy, yeah.
Cool. Well, that's the latest. It's published this year, so...
Yep. It's in all your libraries, hopefully.
Yes, yep. It is, indeed. So it reminds me, we're talking about screen time, about the calculator. So being holiday time, I wanted to ask you, in the era of the Internet of Things and screen time and devices, from your experiences, how should we go about getting our kids to read more? What's the trick to getting the reluctant reader to read?
Okay, so it's really important to understand the playing field. We were sold a lemon in 2013. We were told ebooks. All you dinosaurs printing books, you can go now. It's the e-generation.
Uh-huh.
Absolute load of rubbish for children. I'm not dismissing, if you're flying to London and you have 20 kilogram allocation for your carry-on, whatever bags, you're not going to take 10 novels. Fair enough. You take your Kindle or your Kobo. That's fine. But for kids, the people who told them to start ditching books and reading screens should be locked up.
Okay.
It was always going to be books for children.
Yeah.
You read it at bed, no blue light stimulating the eyes, and you use the words to make the movies play in your head using your creativity. No gizmos and gadgets and things firing off. Just give the kids books with words and 2D pictures, standard colour pictures, and let their imagination fill in all the blanks.
Okay. Thank you so much, children's author Peter Millett. That's wonderful. So we've run out of time now.
Fine.
We'll have to get you back.
I'll come for the sequel.
Yeah, yes. Well, we're dying to find out what your next venture is or how the stand-up comedy acts are going.
Cool.
So thank you for coming in today and joining us on Books and Beyond, and we look forward to chatting with you another time. Happy New Year.
Thanks, same for you. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Ka kite anō.
Brought to you by Auckland Libraries. Find us online at aucklandlibraries.govt.nz and catch
catch the program next Sunday at 9:35 p.m. on 104.6 FM or anytime online at planetaudio.org.nz/books and beyond. Every day, every day, every day, every day.